Hi, this is the voice, Michael Schiavello. You're listening to the Premium Oddscast, hosted by leading MMA odds maker Nick Kalikas, fight scientist and author of Fightnomics, Reid Kuhn, and MMA journalist Brian Heminger. The absolute best UFC betting info, picks, statistics, and analysis from the most respected authority in mixed martial arts betting, MMAOddsBreaker.com.
Welcome to the Premium Oddscast, presented by Five Dime Sportsbook. I'm Brian Heminger, joined today by leading mixed martial arts odds maker Nick Kalikas to break down this Saturday's UFC 203 event, which takes place in Cleveland, Ohio. If you're unfamiliar with our format, myself and Nick will break down the fight card from top to bottom, providing extensive analysis and a pick for each fight after doing our film study for the event. Looking back at our last event, we didn't have any premium bets for UFC Fight Night 93, and we pushed our one-unit free bet on Yara Stanho when his fight was ruled a majority draw. Back to the present, UFC 203 features a 12-fight card in total and will be aired on UFC Fight Pass, Fox Sports 1, and pay-per-view this Saturday night. Let's dive right in. Now, kicking off the fight card on Fight Pass is a lightweight contest between Drew Dober, who is 16-7 with one no contest, and UFC newcomer Jason Gonzalez, who is 10-2. Now, Nick, where did you open this fight, and how has the public shifted things so far?
I opened Dober -180, the comeback on Gonzalez at +140. Looking over to our sponsored sportsbook, 5dimes.eu, it is currently Dober -170, the comeback on Gonzalez at +150. So not a lot of action coming in, not a lot of movement. Line margins are basically tightened up. And I think there's a lot of people that just probably want to avoid this fight altogether. I mean, it's a tough one because we know that Dober's a solid fighter. We know what he's about. I mean, he's a very difficult out to make your UFC official UFC debut with for sure. But I mean, there's a lot of unknowns about Gonzalez. For the diehard fans that haven't watched Tough 22, they probably don't know who this guy is, but he was a Tough 22 vet. He went 1-1 on the show. He won by TKO, but he lost a very competitive decision too. So it is what it is. I mean, I thought he actually didn't look too bad on the show. But at the same time, a lot of people aren't going to give him a ton of respect either. So he is stepping in on short notice for Coke in this spot against Dober. And just, I guess I'll start off with Gonzalez here because that's probably the guy that most people need to learn about more so. Gonzalez is actually pretty good. I think he's been nothing but impressive with all the film study that I've done with him and everything that I've been able to dig up. He's actually a pretty solid fighter. He's long, good size at lightweight. He's an aggressive striker, throws kicks very often, and it's really a big part of his attack. He can be very effective with his kicking game. And also, he's got really solid knees, of course, in the clinch. He's got great timing with it as well. And then even his hands, his boxing are really is not too bad. I mean, so he can, his striking aspect, he mixes things up so well. He's a little bit unorthodox, and he's very accurate, and he has power enough to knock people out and be very effective too. So a lot of good things to like about his striking. Now his ground skill definitely needs a little bit of work. That's where he's weak at, but it's not that he's completely out of his element though. I mean, his takedown defense is okay, but he can be put on his back. And he will get worked over by better ground fighters, better grapplers on the ground a little bit and control him at least in that aspect. But overall, I think he's got decent sub defense and his ability to scramble back up to the feet isn't too bad. And he's also finished several fights by submission. So he's not totally lost on the ground, but I still think overall, even though he's a pretty well-rounded fighter, again, by better grapplers, wrestlers that can control him on the ground, that's probably his kryptonite. Dober might be able to do some of that. I mean, obviously Dober has a wrestling background. He's a very strong, powerful guy coming into this fight. He's very aggressive. His boxing is a bit underrated. He's a very accurate striker as well. He's got power to go along with it. And he does look for some takedowns and he does have a good submission game. So that's why this fight is so intriguing to me. I think it's going to come down to can Gonzalez really stay off his back? And if he does, I think Dober, I mean, he's game. He's a very tough guy to stop, but on the feet, Gonzalez is going to have an edge. I mean, he's going to be throwing those kicks. He's going to be the aggressor on the feet as far as picking Dober apart and landing a little bit more often, cleaner, I think. And Dober, even though he's a tough guy, I think he's going to be able to, Gonzalez is going to be able to have a lot of success on the feet and maybe even knock Dober out. So it all depends on Gonzalez. If he can sprawl, brawl, keep this fight upright long enough, I think he could win on the scorecards. I think he could even possibly finish Dober. Dober's going to need to do what he does best, kind of grind Gonzalez out here, get some takedowns and just kind of probably more than anything else win on the scorecards because I don't think he finishes Gonzalez even with short notice. And I should mention this real quick, even though I'm talking about the short notice. Gonzalez's cardio isn't too bad. I expect him, even though this is a short notice fight, I don't think he's going to suffer too much. So I think you kind of almost have to throw that out the window as at least being a drastic part of Gonzalez's coming into this fight and being underestimated. I think he has enough cardio that he can survive against Dober. So I don't think Dober gets Gonzalez out of there. I think he's going to have to win on the scorecards, where I think Gonzalez can win on the cards and he can actually possibly finish Dober as well. So I'm actually going to go with the underdog and Lean Gonzalez. I was impressed with him, and I think this is going to be a huge win for him if he gets the job done here.
Jason Gonzalez is definitely somebody you shouldn't be sleeping on. Drew Dober is a solid veteran. He gets things done. In his last fight against Scott Holtzman, he actually grinded out a solid grappler. Holtzman was known for his ground game, and it was Dober that was getting all the takedowns and riding out top position and winning rounds, and that's what helped him win that fight. If he employs a similar game plan against Jason Gonzalez, as long as he avoids submission trouble, he could definitely win this fight. I think the best way for Dober to win is a decision. Gonzalez, on the other hand, he's finished all 10 of his career victories, 11 if you include the Ultimate Fighter when he put out Tim Welch. But for the most part, Gonzalez is a ferocious striker on the feet with a lot of power, uses kicks very well, especially at the end of combinations, so they can be something that maybe Dober just doesn't see coming. And then when he does go to the ground, he has a savvy submission game, although for the most part when he's on the ground, it's because he's been put on his back. So he's throwing up triangle chokes, he's throwing up arm bars. So for the most part, Gonzalez is a guy that wants to keep the fight standing, wants to put a hurt on his opponent on the feet, and if he's put on his back, he's going to be mildly dangerous, but I don't know if it's dangerous enough that it's something that could catch Dober. I mean, Dober did get submitted by a guillotine choke from Efrain Escudero, so that is something you have to consider. So he can't just be reckless with his takedowns. But if this stays standing, Dober's given up 6 inches in height. He's giving up a bit of reach as well. So I expect Jason Gonzalez to do really well on the feet. Although Gonzalez's defense on the feet is not very good, it's not like Dober is a powerhouse. He doesn't have nearly the punch, the pack in his punch that Gonzalez has. And Gonzalez mixes it up pretty well too. So I think, honestly, if Dober wins, it's going to be wrestling, but I think there's a really good chance that along the way, either Dober gets caught with a submission or knocked out, maybe. So I actually think Jason Gonzalez can pull off this upset as well. Now moving up to the light heavyweight division, we have CB Dolloway returning to 205 with a 16-9 record, taking on Francimar Barroso, who is 18-5. Now, Nick, what's the MMA oddsmaker's perspective on this one?
I opened Dolloway -190 to come back on Barroso at +150. Looking over at 5 Dimes right now, it's Dolloway -175. Barroso is +155. So similar discussion as the last fight as far as line movement goes. Line margins is basically tightened up. It's pretty close to where it opened here. And there's not a ton of action either way on this fight, because I think a lot of people kind of want to avoid it. I mean, let's face it. Dolloway is definitely a really good fighter, really tough out at middleweight especially, but he is moving up to 205. So that's one thing you have to consider here in this spot. And Dolloway's a very good mixed martial artist. It's his chin that is a huge, huge concern. And that's why I think people aren't stepping in here and just going nuts and putting Dolloway in a ton of parlays or just trusting him altogether, because this is a winnable fight for Dolloway. I mean, Barroso is definitely a tough opponent, but Dolloway, I think, is the better mixed martial artist all around. I mean, especially his grappling aspect of things. I mean, his ground game, he usually out-wrestles most people that he faces. There's not too many people that that he's really struggled against and that aspect of it. I mean, he manages to get the job done. His striking's not bad offensively either. He's got a little bit of power, his boxing, everything. I mean, his kicks are pretty solid, but it's that defense and it's that chin that lets him down from time to time. And if Barroso wins, it's probably going to be because of that. So Barroso, another guy that's pretty well-rounded. I mean, he actually has underrated wrestling in his own right, takedown game, submission game, but he's more well-known for his striking ability too. So you have a striker in Barroso that's in his weight class at 205 pounds, taking on a guy that's stepping up from 185 pounds coming into his weight class as well. And he's an underdog in this spot. So I do see it though. I understand why. I think Dalloway can outgrapple Brasso. I mean, Brasso actually has great takedown defense. If you look at it, I mean, he's fended off most of the takedown attempts that he's had against him, but Dalloway is a different type of grappler. I think if anybody can get him to the floor and control him a little bit, it's a guy like Dalloway. So I expect Dalloway to kind of grind this fight out, even though he's stepping up a weight class. I think he's still going to be able to maybe slow the tempo of this fight up against, the cage with Brasso, get some takedowns along the way. And then Brasso is not getting any younger. I mean, he's 36 years old. He's been knocked out a few times throughout his career as well. So realistically, if either one of these guys catch each other in the chin and knock each other out, I wouldn't be shocked. So I am going to lean a little bit more towards Dalloway. I think he is just a better fighter. I think, he should get back on track and get things rolling. Maybe at 205 for him as well. I'm not sure what his plans are, his future plans, if he plans on dropping back down to 185 or taking fights in both divisions. But either way, I think Dalloway is definitely the more talented fighter here, and more times than not, he should get the W. So minus his chin, I think he's going to get the win, and I'm going to go Dalloway's way.
One thing we have seen when fighters move up a weight class is their chins usually get a little bit better, even though they're facing guys that hit a little harder. Maybe just the extra weight cut that they were doing doesn't take its toll on them, and they're able to take a punch a little bit better. You saw it with Dustin Poirier especially. Now, Francois Barroso, he's not exactly a monster heavy hitter, so it's not something I'm super concerned about against Dalloway. But that being said, Dalloway's chin is bad enough that, you know, even if Barroso doesn't have a lot of power, if he connects solidly, he could still put him out. But the thing I like about Dalloway is the fact that he's well-rounded. I mean, he's a great wrestler, and there aren't a lot of great wrestlers in the light heavyweight division. So if Dalloway can shoot in for a takedown and avoid, you know, leaving his neck out for a guillotine like he did, I think the last time he was at light heavyweight against Tom Lawler, then he should be fine. The takedowns are going to be huge for him here. If he could utilize that part of his game, I don't see how Barroso can respond to it. I think he can just wear Barroso down with takedowns. I think he can grind him out for a decision if he needs to. But I think if he can just repeatedly get takedowns against Barroso, then at some point the finish will become available. Dalloway can get a finish with a submission or just pounding him out on the ground. And on the feet, this should be competitive. I don't think Barroso is a way better striker than Dalloway. Dalloway's actually shown some solid overall offensive striking and improved defense. It's just if he gets caught, he's toast. So, for the most part, I think this is Dalloway's fight to lose. He just has to avoid getting checked on the chin. And if he does that, then he should win. Now, closing out the Fight Pass prelims, we have a welterweight contest between Yancy Medeiros, who is 12-4 with one no contest, and Sean Spencer, who is 12-5. Now, Nick, where did you open this fight, and how has the public shifted things so far?
I put Medeiros minus 160, the comeback on Spencer at plus 120. Right now it's Medeiros minus 130, the comeback on Spencer is plus 110. So line margins have tightened up a little bit, and the 10-cent drop on the dog, not too drastic, but there is a little bit more action coming in Spencer's way. I get it. I understand it. Medeiros, in my opinion, to me at least, I mean, I respect the guy for sure. He's a warrior. There's been a lot of hype even before he made his UFC debut. I mean, he cut from huge, I mean, he was fighting a light heavyweight for crying out loud. And he cut all the way down to lightweight. The UFC gave him time. They brought him in. They tried to do everything right for him and kind of make his debut at 155 the best they can, even though they put him in the top fight in that spot. But still, there was a lot of high expectations with Medeiros. And part of me sees what they saw in him. I mean, the guy's a warrior. He's tough as nails. He has really outstanding, I want to say striking offense at times. I mean, his hands are definitely good. He's got power to go along with it. He's got that killer instinct. I mean, the guy's a finisher. So offensively, he's definitely a threat to most people. He's fun to watch, but defensively is a mess for me. And that's where his stock has really dropped, in my opinion. I mean, I wasn't expecting Medeiros even from the beginning to be as bad as he is defensively. I mean, hitting that body for him. I mean, a lot of fighters suffer, you know, don't absorb body punishment too well. Medeiros is one of those guys, unfortunately, that seems to be the case even more so than normal. And then that chin defensively. He's been chin checked as well. He gets wobbled. He gets dropped. He's tough now. He can survive in some spots for sure. But I mean, defensively, he just gets tagged too much. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, those are the concerns for Medeiros. He can dish it out. He seems to take it like a warrior, but at the same time, he just gets hit too often. And against a guy like Spencer, which is a little bit underrated, I think, in the striking element. I mean, he's got really good boxing. He's got a little bit of power to go along with it. He's a smart fighter. It's a tough fight. I mean, for both these guys are going to really push each other to the max. And it's definitely going to be, I think, a competitive matchup in all aspects of the game. Now, Medeiros, I should mention, is moving up from 155 to 170 in this fight. So we were just talking about Dolloway moving up in weight. Here's another situation that Medeiros moving up in weight. And I am definitely interested to seeing him, you know, compete and maybe start competing steady at 170 pounds and see where he can go with this move. But Spencer is going to be game. I mean, the guy has good takedown defense. He's got, like I said, good offensive boxing. He's a smart fighter. He pushes a high pace as well. The problem with Spencer, though, I just mentioned some flaws with Medeiros. You could say some of the same things. I think his striking defense overall is better than Medeiros, but he still does get clipped a little bit more than you'd like to see. He's been getting wobbled. He's been getting rocked. He's been knocked out in the past as well. He's not getting any younger. I mean, in fight years, he's starting to get up there a little bit more because he's starting to get into all sorts of wars in his brief UFC career, it seems. So my hesitation both ways in this fight is real. I mean, I really can't trust either guy here. So for me, as far as a betting perspective goes, I would honestly just stay away and see what happens, because I think one of these guys is probably going to get finished along the way, or we could see a classic three-round war. I kind of hope it goes three rounds and it is an exciting type of fight, but man, I really can't trust either guy. So I'm going to slightly lean towards Medeiros a little bit in this spot. But it's not a confident pick, and I think it could go either way, and I could see why people are coming in on Spencer as an underdog, because it is a dog or pass situation for sure. But I'm going to lean just a little bit more towards Medeiros. I think I just give him a very slight edge, basically.
This is more the battle of technique versus unpredictability. With Medeiros moving up to welterweight, it's not a disadvantage because he was a very big lightweight. I mean, he cut a lot of weight to make 155, and I'm pretty sure he has the exact same measurements as Spencer. I mean, both have a 75-inch reach. Both have 41-inch leg reach. Both are 70 inches tall. So there's really no difference in terms of measurables. It's all about their skills, and their skills are definitely different. Sean Spencer is definitely on the more technical side. He has the probing jab. He throws in combination. Doesn't have a ton of pure knockout power, but he does rock his opponents every once in a while. And Yancy Medeiros, on the other hand, he is extremely aggressive, throws recklessly, wildly at times, often wings kicks, has spinning attacks, has an aggressive ground game as well. So Spencer will definitely be on his toes, but if Spencer has a composed game plan and doesn't let down his guard, then I think he's going to be in a good spot here. Medeiros, on top of being wild and reckless, he has atrocious striking defense. So if Spencer can just get a straight jab going, I think he can just keep that right in Medeiros' face and start lighting him up. And while Medeiros doesn't have a terrible chin, he does get rocked, and I think Spencer can definitely take advantage of that. Spencer, I think, does have the worst chin of the two, so if Medeiros lands something huge, he could put Spencer out. That being said, Spencer usually makes up for his chin not being great by having really good striking defense. He gets hit 15% less of the time than Medeiros does, so that can really help him out here. So overall, I think these guys are very evenly matched. It's just all about who is able to dictate their game plan a little bit. And as long as Spencer can avoid that one big shot, then I think that he's going to be able to grind out a decision here. So my pick is going to be Sean Spencer. Now, kicking off the preliminary card on Fox Sports 1, we have Ian McCall, who is 13-5-1, taking on Ray Borg, who is 9-2. Now, Nick, what's the MMA odds maker's perspective on this one?
Up in McCall, minus 160, the comeback on Borg at plus 120. Right now, looking over five dimes, it is McCall minus 130, the comeback on Borg is plus 110. So line margins have tightened up a little bit, 10-cent drop on the dog. There has been some two-way action coming into this fight, though, as well, because early action was Borg. Now we're starting to see more action coming in on McCall as well. So this was a tough line to set. I mean, several of these lines, if you look at it from top to bottom on this card, it was tough. It was not easy because, you know, all of them are definitely going to be, for the most part, competitive fights. And, I mean, the lines as a whole still indicate that. I mean, you're talking about two fights that are over 200 you know, as far as odds go. So the rest of them are under 200. And of course, a lot of them are pick-up type of fights. And this is definitely one of those as well. So you have a savvy vet in McCall that gets a ton of respect from the public, from the MMA community, from the bettors out there always. I mean, the guy is definitely a tough out. I mean, look at his wars with Demetrius Johnson. I mean, he's top of the food chain when it comes to the flyweight division. And he's always in the mix in consideration for a title shot. I mean, the guy is, it's definitely one of the toughest outs because he has the total package. The guy is such a complete fighter. I mean, he's got hand speed. He's got good footwork and movement. He's hard to really pin down and catch, with your striking. The guy has really good timing with his wrestling and his takedown game. I mean, he takes down most people that he's in the cage with. So that's really impressive as well. He's got good top control, good ground and pound. He's got a little bit of submission game to go along with it. So McCall is truly a great fighter, and he deserves to be in the top tier of the flyweights and kind of in that title mix. But if you look at some of his fights a little bit more recently, I mean, you can see a bit of a decline. The guy's been around for so long. He's been in so many wars throughout his career that even though he's performing relatively well, I mean, he's been in some tough fights. Even the ones that he's won recently have been very competitive to the point where he's squeaking by a little bit. And it, to me, it seems like he is starting to slow down in round two a little bit, in round three as the fight progresses a little bit as well. So that's something to kind of watch out for McCall. And he's facing a very hungry veteran, or I should say not really a veteran at this point. I mean, he's still fairly new to the UFC, but he's not a rookie anymore at this point. He's starting to get that experience, that UFC experience, and especially in his last fight. I mean, taking on a guy like Scoggins for Borg, I think even though he got the loss, is going to really, really be great for his career because Scoggins was such a tough matchup for Borg. I mean, going into that fight, Borg was obviously the favorite, but how it all played out, I mean, Borg typically has the edge in wrestling. He's got the edge on the feet in most cases. Against Scoggins, obviously that wasn't the case, but I mean, he's just a tough out, but Scoggins was able to actually work him on the feet a little bit with his striking and then actually control the wrestling aspect of it in the ground game, which Borg really never gets dominated on the ground like he did against Scoggins. I mean, he's always able to reverse out of position, get top position, take somebody's back. I mean, he's a great scrambler. And even though he did have a little bit of success against Scoggins in that department, every time Scoggins got him down, he was able to get out. It just took him a little bit of while, you know, some time to do that. And Scoggins was just kind of raking up some points. Well, what I'm trying to say with that fight and how much of an impact it has, I mean, that was a big reality check for Borg. I mean, that was definitely a tougher fight than McCall is going to be for him. I think these guys match up a lot better as far as, I mean, actual size as well. I mean, the reach is going to be similar. Their height's going to be similar. A lot of similarities across the board with these two fighters. I think McCall definitely has a stand-up edge overall, because he's got that speed and he's got a little bit of power to go along with it. And his movement is really nice. But I think on the ground, Borg has a much bigger edge, because I think even though McCall might have the better wrestling, he might get a takedown or two in this fight against Borg, but Borg is going to reverse things. McCall is not going to be able to hold Borg down. And I think it's going to be a mistake if he goes to the ground with Borg, because I think Borg is going to, even if he gets put on his back right away, he's going to get a superior position. And I think he could realistically sub McCall on the ground. I mean, that's how dominant Borg's ground game is at times. So he's not going to have the success, I think, that Scoggins had against Borg. So this is a better fight for Borg. And another thing I like about, on the feet, Borg does push a little bit more of the pace. He's going to be the one kind of pressing forward a little bit. McCall's going to be on his back foot. So I think even though McCall is going to be landing some clean punches along the way and could be the more effective striker, Borg's going to be the one coming forward, being a little bit more aggressive, shooting for those takedowns. McCall's going to be sprawling and brawling a little bit along the way. So for me, this just feels like it's time to pass the torch on a little bit. And Borg is going to be the next real contender, I think, at 125 pounds. And he's going to do that by beating McCall in a very close fight. I could even see this fight honestly ending on the ground. I mean, McCall's tough to stop, but if anybody could sub McCall, it's a guy like Borg. So I think there's a slight chance Borg finishes on the ground. If not, I think if it hits the scorecards, it's going to be very competitive, but I think Borg is going to pull out a decision as well. So I am going to pick Ray Borg to pull off the upset win over McCall.
For me, this fight boils down to how much McCall has left in the tank. He hasn't fought since January 31st of 2015, which is ages ago. I mean, that's like 20 months. And Ray Borg, I know that his last performance was not impressive, but if Ian McCall is not motivated, then I think Borg definitely will have a chance to pull this off. The main thing, though, is Ian McCall at one point was the best flyweight in the planet, and he might still bring those skills to the game. I mean, we just don't know. It's been so long since we've seen him. He has a lot of other interests going on right now. I think he's working to start a marijuana dispensary in California. He's got a bunch of side projects. You know, he's a busy guy. I don't, if MMA is not his top priority right now, then Ray Borg will definitely have a huge opportunity. That being said, when Ian McCall is at the top of his game, he is very difficult to beat. I mean, this is the guy that made Demetrius Johnson look more vulnerable than any other fighter in the history of the flyweight division. So if he brings that game to the table, then I think Ray Borg's going to have some trouble. McCall has excellent wrestling and potentially could stifle Borg on the ground if he gets everything going. I mean, he did stifle Formiga back when he fought him in Tachi Palace back in the day. So he's definitely capable of that. And on the feet, Borg is still a work in progress. I know he's putting in a lot of time on the feet to improve his stand-up, but McCall is more experienced there, and even though he's not a big, powerful striker, I think McCall is the better stand-up artist. So I think he wins the striking exchanges. I think McCall probably wins top position on the ground, although Borg is definitely craftier with submissions and transitions. So that is something you'll have to look out for. If Borg forces a lot of ground scrambles, that could be definitely to his advantage. I mean, the guy is constantly improving. He's still very young as well, so he's always adding more to his game. But so he could be catching McCall at the perfect time in his career. But if he's not, then I could see McCall just kind of taking his time with this, not rushing into anything, and just almost grinding out a decision on the feet or securing top position and maybe just keeping it real close so that Borg doesn't have a lot of space to work, to get a sweep, to get a transition, to throw a submission attempt up. So I'm going to slightly side with Ian McCall. I just don't quite think that he's done yet. So I think he can pull out a decision here. Now moving up to the lightweight division, we have Nick Lentz, who is 28-7-2 with one no contest, taking on Michael McBride, who is 8-1. Now, Nick, where did you open this fight, and how has the public shifted things so far?
Up in Lentz, minus 350, the comeback on McBride at plus 250. Right now, action is coming in on Lentz. It's minus 470 right now, 5 dimes. The comeback on McBride is plus 375. Market price out there, though, is still about 4-1. So 5 dimes seems to be the highest spot right now on Nick Lentz, and a lot of that is guaranteed parlay action as well. I mean, they're probably getting everybody's throwing Lentz in a parlay. And you know what? That's, I can understand that as well. I mean, it would be a common thing to do. Lentz is a very tough out. McBride's making his UFC debut on short notice. And really, if you look at Lentz's skill set, I mean, the guy has striking on the feet. He's got power on the feet. He's got a good wrestling game. He's got a good submission game. So how do you beat a guy like that? I mean, unless you're just exceptional and just really a future title contender. I mean, Lentz is the type of fighter right now that is an outstanding gatekeeper at 145 pounds or 155 pounds. If you could come in and beat a guy like Nick Lentz, you're doing some great things and you got a bright future ahead of you in the UFC. So that's how tough of an out Lentz is. But those people out there that are betting Lentz, I guarantee you, or have not really done their research on McBride. I mean, McBride is not a bad fighter, right? You can look back at his resume. You can see that loss that he had to, Sanchez from, well, Bellator veteran Sanchez, and it was an RFA or whatnot. You look at that fight and I understand it, but McBride, I think, has since gotten better. There's not, and I should say this, by the way, as well. There's not a tremendous amount of footage out there on McBride. You're going to have to really dig deep, to do some good research on this fight. And so a lot of people are just kind of going to be betting this fight a little blindly as well. So with the movement and the action, I'm not surprised by it, but there's a lot of blind bets going in there. So that's not a good formula for success. So be careful on this fight. Those of you guys that want to come in and go kind of crazy on this spot, thinking the Lentz is a sure thing. I mean, McBride is the MCC lightweight champion. It's not a bad division or not a bad organization, I should say, outside of the UFC. He's, of course, I just mentioned an RFA and Bellator veteran. So he has some decent experience outside for the lower level competitions overall. And I mean, most of his comp is definitely cans, but there is a couple of spots on there, like I said, that he has been tested for kind of the lower tier organizations out there. The way he goes about things, I mean, the background with McBride, what you're going to get from him, I mean, he has a BJJ wrestling background. I mean, the guy is more of a ground-based fighter for sure. He looks for the takedowns. He looks for the submission games. He's long. He's rangy for the lightweight division. He's definitely big. So with a good ground game and with the size that he has and with the ability to get the fight to the ground in most cases, I mean, the guy is a tough out for a lot of people. But at the same time, he can be put on his back. And he can be controlled a little bit. And Lentz is definitely going to look to do that. But McBride does utilize a pretty good butterfly guard and looks for scrambles, and he really searches for subs off his back as well. So he's not an easy guy to deal with on the ground, especially with his length. So Lentz is going to have to still be a little careful going for those takedowns and trying to control McBride. And then on the feet, even though McBride is more of a ground fighter, grappler type of base fighter, he does have some underrated stand-up skills as well. But most of that is to set up his takedowns and to get the fight to the floor. So not an easy fight for Lentz, but it is a fight that he probably should win, especially with McBride coming in on short notice. And not being as consistent of a fighter the last couple years or whatnot. I mean, this is definitely an indicator that Lentz should win this fight. I just don't necessarily agree with the crazy action moving Lentz's way like it's already a done deal. I think it's going to be a scrap. McBride's going to show up and challenge Lentz for sure. But I do think Lentz is going to pass the test and probably just grind McBride out, maybe even get a late finish as it goes. But I'm going to pick Lentz, but it's not a favorite or pass situation, especially at the line right now. Just pass it. I mean, just stay away from this fight until we see what McBride is really made of against UFC level competition. I don't think it's a smart move to even touch this fight, to be honest with you. So my pick is Lentz, but as far as a betting standpoint, stay away from it.
I'm a little bit more confident in Lentz than Nick is, but overall, Michael McBride is definitely dangerous. I mean, he's going to enter this fight with a huge size advantage over Lentz. I mean, he is 8 inches in reach, 5 inches in height, legs are 2 inches longer. I mean, everywhere across the board, if he can keep it standing, then he might have a decent shot because he's not a terrible striker. Lentz isn't that bad on the feet either. But when this goes to the ground, which is where McBride usually likes to go, I think Lentz is just so much more experienced there against such better competition. I mean, you have to look through and say, who has really controlled Nick Lentz on the ground? Who are the fighters that have given him fits on the canvas throughout his career? And there aren't many. I mean, to be completely honest, I mean, it's like Charles Oliveira, who is one of the greatest submission fighters in the history of the UFC lower weight classes, and Evan Dunham had some success, and maybe, you know, Mark Bocek. You know, guys that were just elite, elite ground fighters, and Chad Mendes, although most of that was on the feet. So I just don't see Michael McBride having that same level of success. McBride is a competent ground fighter, but his takedown defense is not very good, actually. Sometimes when he throws kicks, he leaves himself wide open to an easy level change or to get the kick caught and get dumped on his back. Now, he does work to scramble back to his feet, so that is a positive thing. But most of his game revolves around getting top position on the ground and then softening up his opponent to try to find a submission. Most of his wins are by submission. And I just don't see him submitting Nick Lentz. I think Nick Lentz is going to be able to grind this out kind of like Nick Lentz always does. Lentz is great at getting takedowns. He's great at securing top position on the floor. And then when he gets top position, it's just a constant barrage of punches. And occasionally he'll look for the submission. And if you do shoot in on a takedown, you got to watch out for the guillotine choke as well. Although sometimes when Lentz goes for that, I mean, he flops to his back and then gives up the position. So that is another thing that Lentz will have to be careful about, because McBride's probably going to be looking for the takedown. So if Lentz's first instinct is to drop to that guillotine and he doesn't get it, he could be spending a bit of time on his back, which is not where he wants to be. That's never where a wrestler wants to be. So overall, I think this fight will be competitive primarily because of McBride's size. But I think once Lentz kind of starts to figure that out and get settled into the fight, I don't really see how McBride is going to be able to hang with Lentz, especially once Lentz starts getting top position, because McBride really doesn't like being on his back, and I think Lentz is going to put him there repeatedly. So my pick is going to be Nick Lentz. Now moving up to the middleweight division, we have Brad Tavares, who is 13-4, taking on Chao Magalhaes, who is 9-2. Now, Nick, what's the MMA odds maker's perspective on this one?
Up in Tavares, -210. The comeback of Magalhaes at +160. Right now, it's Tavares -185. Magalhaes still +160. So line margins have tightened up a little bit. And it's another spot where I think people are really not going crazy to bet this fight. My times have changed. I mean, Tavares at one point was an up-and-coming guy at middleweight for sure. Like a lot of people believe that, I mean, he was a complete fighter. I mean, the type of fighter that could actually fend off takedown attempts, keep the fight upright, his wrestling game a little bit underrated, and then power on the feet, pushing a very high pace, a smart fighter. I mean, his work throughout the years and his improvement has been definitely noticed. So the Tavares has made himself, and with his trainers, everybody around him has definitely made him into a contender at one point, or at least we thought he was. But then reality kind of struck a little bit, and we're seeing the struggles for him. And it's unfortunate because we're saying this about quite a few fighters on this card, but it's the chin. You know, I mean, the guys that are a bit chinny, that have the skill, I'm so frustrated for them as well. Because, I mean, if Tavares' chin was a little bit better, the guy could realistically make a run towards UFC gold at 185. I mean, again, will he ever wear it? I'm not sure he's championship caliber, but he's right there in the mix as far as his skill set. Because, again, he does have the striking ability. He can push a high pace, and he's hung in there with some pretty solid fighters. So Tavares is no slouch. It's just that chin you have to worry about. So Magalhaes, on the other hand, he's more known for his grappling ability, more known for his ability to kind of grind people out as well. Now he's been starting to get some power on the feet or more confidence on the feet. He's been knocking people out a little bit. So he's more of a threat on the feet as well. And he is improving. I mean, he's been training with Glover Teixeira for a while now. And you can see the improvement, the confidence all around in Magalhaes' game is definitely at another level right now. So it's something that you'd like to see, but he's coming in again off of a loss that he's been out since July 2015. And that loss was to Saman and by submission. So I was shocked by how easy Saman was able to actually get that W over Magalhaes. I wasn't expecting that at all. It just kind of blew him out of the water. So he's coming off a pretty devastating loss, and it's been a while. And I should mention Tavares has been out for a while as well. He's been out since his loss to Whitaker, which was in May of 2015. And to note, he's lost 3 out of 4, and 2 of them were by knockout for Tavares. So Tavares is kind of on that decline spot that you don't want to see in a fighter, especially at only age 28. And Magalhaes is coming off a loss that he wants to obviously get back on track when he was seemingly he was making some progress. I mean, Magalhaes was definitely getting better, and he was starting to at least get some respect in the middleweight division. But I mean, that all changed with one fight here recently. So both these guys need to get back on track. Both these guys need to get a W here. And really what it comes down to, if Tavares doesn't get clipped in this fight, I don't know how Magalhaes beats him, because he's not the better striker. I don't think he's going to be able to take Tavares down and control him, because he's shown really good takedown defense in the past. So this is Tavares' fight to win or lose. I mean, he can outstrike Magalhaes. He could probably finish Magalhaes on the feet if he pushes the pace and really is the aggressor here in this fight. But can he get clipped? Will Magalhaes throw a big bomb, a big haymaker, and touch that chin and Tavares go down? It's a possibility. So that's where the tentativeness definitely comes in this spot. So for me, I'm going to pick Tavares. I think he is the better fighter. More times than not, he should get the win, but I just don't trust him as much right now. He's going to have to show us all that he can sit there and absorb some punishment a little bit better, and that this time off really did him some good, and he gets back on track and strings a few wins together before I could really start trusting Tavares again. But right now, I am going to pick Tavares to beat Magalhaes.
Yeah, as Nick said, the only thing standing in the way of Brad Tavares completely destroying this fight is the chin. I mean, it's not like all of his recent performances were terrible. I mean, he dominated Nate Marquardt, looked great in that fight, and he was absolutely blistering Tim Boach, just smoking him, and then he got hit with a jab, and that set up a knockout. So the main thing here is defense, 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 because offensively, Tavares is fine. He's accurate, he pushes a high pace, he's good in the clinch, he's good at distance, he has a nice jab. He's got the complete package offensively. It's just, he just can't take a good shot. So hopefully this time off did him some well. His chin is rested up a little bit. Hopefully he has a good weight cut. But for the most part, he just cannot let Magalhaes land a big shot. If you watched his last loss, which was over a year ago now, but to Robert Whittaker. Whittaker just swarmed him and took him out right away. Whittaker is an aggressive fighter with a lot of power, and that's how he was able to win. So Magalhaes, if you actually watch those knockout wins that he picked up against Luke Zakarich and Trevor Smith, he got right in their grill and took them out immediately. So that's the one thing Tavares cannot let happen. He needs to be on guard immediately, because that's where Magalhaes is going to be most dangerous, is in those opening couple minutes. And if Magalhaes does not get the knockout in the first couple minutes, then I'm not sure he will at all. Because once Tavares kind of gets settled down and settled in, I think he will get a nice rhythm going. He'll get his groove back a little bit. And then I see Tavares just completely smoking Magalhaes. Magalhaes has a decent ground game and a lot of power, but that's about it. He's not nearly as technical as Tavares. So as long as he can avoid a big overhand punch, then Brad Tavares is going to win either a decision or maybe, you know, kind of wear Magalhaes down as the fight goes on and maybe put him away late. So my pick is also going to be Brad Tavares. Now moving on to the main event of the preliminary card, we have Jessica Evil Eye, who is 11-5 with one no contest, taking on Betch Kohea, who is 9-2. Now, Nick, where did you open this fight, and how has the public shifted things so far?
Up in I minus 150, the comeback on Kohea plus 110, and right now looking over five dimes, it's I minus 145. Kohea is plus 125, so line margins have tightened up a little bit here as well. Man, I don't know. I mean, as far as this fight goes, Kohea definitely deserves a little bit of respect, and that's why I'm happy to hesitate starting this fight off a little bit with it. Because Kohea, for most of us, and most of the diehards out there, I mean, she just doesn't get that. Even though she was in that title shot with Ronda Rousey, and she got smoked in that fight, by the way, but even earning that shot, I mean, just a lot of people just don't respect Kohea at this point. I think she gained and changed that a little bit with her last performance. I mean, you got to give her, you like her, hate her, whatever you want with Betch Kohea. She is a pretty decent fighter. I mean, her fight against Pennington, she was a warrior. She made it close. I mean, it was a split decision, and it was honestly a split decision type of fight. A lot of times we see a split decision, and it might not be the case because judges are just morons. But honestly, watching that fight, I mean, if it went the other way, you couldn't argue it too much. I mean, Pennington, I think, deserved to get the nod, but it was a close competitive fight. So Pennington, in my opinion, is a pretty underrated fighter, a very solid fighter. So for Kohea to finally get tested like that and to come out, even in a loss, I think she came out ahead as far as her stock rose, in my opinion. So with all that being said, I think she's going to be competitive with Jessica Eye. That's why you're seeing the line like this as well. And a lot of fans out there, I think, have kind of hopped off Jessica Eye's bandwagon a little bit. I mean, she was an extremely popular fighter, a lot of hype behind Jessica Eye coming into the UFC. And with her losses, I think slowly that's kind of changed the complexion or their opinion on Jessica Eye, and that's why it's even a little bit more of a competitive line here. And some of her performances as of late, I mean, that McMahon fight, I think, was probably one of her worst performances to date. Stylistically, I know it's kind of a tough matchup because McMahon's wrestling is just outstanding, and that's the type of fighter she is, and it's been kind of Jessica Eye's kryptonite in the past. But I was still expecting better in that spot. I was just way too tentative. She didn't let her hands go. I think, you know, the threat of the takedown really did stifle her offense a little bit. So outside of that, though, if you look at it, I don't think the criticism for Jessica Eye is really that fair. I mean, if you look at Juliana Pena, that fight was really close. She lost a very competitive unanimous decision there against Misha Tate. She was actually winning that fight before Tate was able to land a bomb and then basically control the rest of that fight there as well. So her loss to Alexis Davis, I'm just kind of giving Jessica Eye some love here because I think she deserves a little bit more respect than people are giving her here. And against Alexis Davis, she won that fight, in my opinion. I mean, it was a bad kind of split decision. It was a close fight. I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it was a fight that she should have won. Now, I mean, I'm going to be clear and honest. I thought she lost the fight before that with Sarah Kaufman. I think that the decision went her way, and I thought Kaufman actually won it. So you got to be neutral. You got to be fair about things. She got a decision she should have probably lost, and then she lost decision she probably should have won. But despite all that, if you look back at all of the fighters that I just mentioned, they all have one thing in common. They're all great. I mean, you cannot compare resumes from Jessica Eye to Kohea. And the thing is here, I mean, Jessica Ai was competitive against most of them. I mean, like I said, her last performance against McMahon was actually the worst of the group. So Jessica Ai is a legit fighter. I mean, she has good stand-up. She's got speed on the feet. She's got overall pretty decent takedown defense. It's not easy to get her on the ground. But again, if you're able to do that and control it a little bit, she does struggle to get off her back, and you could beat her in that aspect. But Kohea is not that type of fighter. Kohea can probably or probably will look to take this fight to the ground. And her wrestling is probably a bit underrated, but I think Jessica will be able to sprawl and brawl fine in this spot. It just depends on her aggression. If she's able to let her hands go and be a little bit more of the fighter that we're used to seeing, a little bit more aggressive, and just kind of come back to her confidence, get back up there a little bit. I think, cause I think that's one big issue with Jessica right now too. She needs to get back on track, get her confidence going again. And this is the perfect fight for her to do that. Even though Kohea is going to be game and it's going to be a pretty competitive fight, it's not going to be an easy fight for Ai. I still think on the feet, I will outpoint Kohea. She's just too fast for her. She's going to be landing a lot more frequently. And I think there's a possibility that Ai actually finishes Kohea on the feet as well. And it's not that Ai finishes a lot of people in her fights, but I think this is the type of matchup that she lands, you know, frequently enough that she could maybe even get a finish here. So even though there's a little bit of action coming in towards Kohea and people are kind of underestimating Ai in this spot, I still think Ai's the better fighter here. And I think more times than not, she should get the win here. So I think she gets back on track. And her confidence starts to improve, and we probably see a better Jessica Ai moving forward, and it all starts here. So I am going to pick Jessica Ai to get the win.
Now, if this had been a year ago, I'd have been certain Jessica Ai would easily win. I mean, Betch Kohea got brutalized by Ronda Rousey, embarrassed. And Jessica Ai, while she didn't have the greatest performance, I mean, she was looking amazing against Misha Tate on the feet. And then she got caught, and then, you know, it all spiraled down from there. So Jessica Ai definitely has the skill and the talent and the ability to hang with a lot of the best fighters in the division. My problem is her defense is not very good at all. I mean, she only blocks 57.6% of all strikes at her. And when you don't have a great chin, that is something that needs serious, serious improvement. Now, Betch Kohea, she doesn't have good defense either, and she did get face planted by Rousey, so, you know, her chin isn't the best, but, I don't think Jessica Ai hits as hard as Rousey, so maybe she won't have to worry about that quite as much. Now, offensively, with, the way that Ai attacks, she's actually much less accurate than Kohea. Kohea does a pretty good job of getting inside on her opponents, and she throws with a bit of power, not pure one-punch power, but power in combination. So Ai is going to have to be on her toes a little bit. She's going to have to use her movement and speed and just try to avoid getting caught with a good shot from Kohea. And if she's able to do that, I think she'll be in decent shape. That being said, Kohea's last fight against Raquel Pennington was razor thin. It honestly could have gone either way. I came into that fight thinking Pennington was going to blow Kohea out of the water because I thought Kohea was overrated. She had been hyped up to face Rousey, and that's just what people remembered. And, you know, she actually looked okay in that fight. I mean, that really honestly could have gone either way. And Jessica Ai in her last fight was just awful. I mean, I know a lot of it had to do with her opponent being an Olympic caliber wrestler in Sarah McMahon. And she was terrified of being put on her back because she knew that once she got taken down, she doesn't get back up. So she was extremely tentative on the feet. She cannot bring that tentativeness back this time around against Kohea because Kohea will just pounce on that and take advantage. She'll push the pace. She'll be the aggressor. She'll win over the judges with a higher work rate. So Jessica Ai is going to have to really get her jab going. That number one is one of her biggest weapons, is keeping a jab in Kohea's face. She has a couple inches in reach on her. She needs to work her kicks and just use that athleticism because Kohea is not a great athlete. My other problem is Ai slows down as the fights go on. Like by the third round, she is not going to be using the same defense, the same head movement, the same avoidance. So I think as this fight wears on, I think Ai starts strong, but I can see Betch Kohea winning the last two rounds and taking the fight or maybe even knocking Ai out. So I think this fight will be close, and I'm actually slightly siding with Betch Kohea to pull this one out. Now, moving on to the pay-per-view main card, we have a women's strawweight bout between Jessica Andrade, who is 14-5, and Joanne Calderwood, who is 11-1. Now, Nick, what's the MMA oddsmaker's perspective on this one?
Up in this fight, Andrade minus 120, Calderwood minus 120, exactly a pick 'em, and the line has shifted. It's now Andrade minus 145, Calderwood is plus 125. So, man, ton of respect for Andrade. I mean, honestly, she's always had a decent amount of respect, so it's not even a big surprise, but Calderwood at the same time has always gotten a ton of respect as well. So in my opinion, you have two ladies here that have been overrated throughout their entire careers. Now, talented fighters for sure and capable of doing some great things in the UFC, and they're starting to actually show it now. So that was my opinion earlier. Now I'm definitely getting more respect for these girls and understanding that what kind of talent they could possibly have or what potential they have, especially if you look back at their last performances. I mean, that's what's fresh in everybody's mind. Andrade drops down to 115 pounds, which is obviously the right weight class for her. I mean, cause she's not a big girl. So I think she looks great at 115 pounds. She's strong. She has speed. I mean, her cardio for as long as that fight lasted against Penne looked actually okay as well. So this is a good move for Andrade. And man, to dispose of Penne the way she did, it was really impressive. So Andrade is just a little beast. She comes forward, throws heavy, throws often, and it just has that killer instinct. And then, of course, you got to watch out for a guillotine choke. I mean, she's got a sick guillotine as well. So Andrade is definitely a talented fighter. But what I was saying about maybe both of these ladies being a little bit overhyped, because they do have some flaws throughout their game for sure. Now they're starting to address it a little bit, and it was a good move for Andrade. So we're going to probably see some of those holes close up a little bit more with this move to 115 pounds. I think it is definitely a good spot for her. Now, Calderwood at the same time, I could say a lot of the same things about her. I mean, she was one of these girls that was supposed to actually win the Ultimate Fighter tournament, or one of the favorites to win it at least. She was up there. I mean, she's had, even before the UFC, she was one of the people that were on everybody's radar talking about how talented she was, a future champion at 115 pounds. And she really just hasn't lived up to those expectations. I mean, she got beat on the show, so that derailed a lot of the plans as well. And then even after that, to be honest with you, she came into the UFC and she looked bad. Even in her wins, she didn't look that good at all. So especially that Moroz fight, I should point out, that was just awful. I mean, but she did have some personal issues that she discussed, you know, back around that time as well. And you could tell mentally she was weird. She wasn't, I don't know. There was something about Calderwood for sure that wasn't sitting right for me. So even though she only lost that fight to Moroz after she entered the UFC, she just looked shaky. But her move up to 125 pounds in her last fight to the flyweight division was amazing, because she fought a very game Letourneau in that spot. And she moved to TriStar, which I think did wonders for her game as well. Because if you look at that fight she had against Letourneau, she wasn't like hesitating or getting flinched, or, you know, when somebody was putting the pressure on her, she wasn't turning her head when she was getting hit. It looked at some points, it looks like Calderwood was actually kind of afraid to get hit. And that's not what you like to see in a fighter. That Letourneau fight, that went all out the window. She absorbed some heavy punishment and she kept on coming forward. I mean, it didn't even faze her. So that was really impressive. And Letourneau is a very talented fighter. I mean, she's a very tough out. And what Calderwood was able to do and actually finish that fight, man, I mean, that was the best performance she's had. She looked mentally game. She looked mentally ready. TriStar with Faraz and crew over there have really worked wonders for Calderwood's game. I think it's got her confidence back again as well. Now she's dropping back down to 115 pounds, and she has a very tough opponent she's facing here. And she's going to have the size advantage. She's going to have the reach advantage in this fight. She's got a lot of attributes that actually favor her in this fight, honestly. I think her wrestling is better than Andrade as well. So everybody coming in Andrade's way, you know what? I mean, I was kind of at the beginning leaning a little bit. This is a true pick'em fight, in my opinion. But I was leaning a little bit more towards Andrade, but I've seen the overwhelming opinion coming in on Andrade, which most of you guys probably that are listening have that opinion as well. And it's kind of made me jump ship a little bit. And when you dig back in a little bit more to this fight, I think Calderwood's going to give her fits. I mean, Calderwood in the clinch is going to give Andrade a lot of problems. Really, what I was saying about the cardio and 115 pounds, I think Andrade is going to probably have even better cardio than she normally does. It's yet to be determined, though. So we're going to have to really see that play out, especially absorbing knees along the way, or absorbing those body shots that Calderwood's going to throw at her. That's definitely going to take a toll on her. So if Andrade is not able to get Calderwood out in the first round, if she's not able to just get her, you know, knocked out, I think as it goes, Calderwood's actually going to be taking over. She might even get this fight to the ground, get top position, work a little ground and pound, and win this fight. So for me, with everybody thinking one way, and Andrade basically has this, and she's the next title contender. She's the next thing at 115 pounds. I'm going to go the other way. And I think Calderwood's actually getting underrated in this spot here now. And I think that Calderwood's actually, from what I've seen, I liked in her last fight. And I hope she keeps that momentum going, because that's the type of Calderwood that everybody was expecting to see back in the day. And she can really build from it and really be a threat at 115 pounds if she continues to make that progress. So I'm going to go with Calderwood here to pull off the upset win over Andrade.
I know Joanne Calderwood looked amazing in her last fight against Letourneau, but there were a few key differences in that fight compared to some of her other performances. Now, in the Moroz fight, in the Courtney Casey fights, where she was in a lot of trouble, in the Rose Namajunas fight, it was all times where somebody quickly got in her face, started landing good shots, and then it went to the ground. And I think in the Letourneau fight, it was all in her comfort zone. It was 10 pounds heavier, so she didn't have nearly the weight cut that she normally does. And it was a fighter that wanted to keep it at distance, that wanted to trade in kickboxing range, which is kind of where Calderwood thrives. She has excellent straight punches. She has really nasty, heavy kicks that can do a lot of damage, both with the push kicks, with just body kicks, leg kicks, and then she can mix it up to the head. That's where she does a lot of her damage. And it's, she can also, of course, dominate on the inside with her Muay Thai when she's the aggressor. But for the most part, all of her damage was done at distance. And I'm not sure that Jessica Andrade is going to give her the space to get a lot of those attacks off. Now, obviously, the knees are going to be there against Andrade, because Calderwood is 3 inches taller, and she definitely has that Muay Thai experience. So if Andrade is just chilling in the clinch, trying to just unload short punches, then the knee to the face, the knees to the body, knees to the leg are definitely going to be available. But I don't think Calderwood really handles the pressure from an opponent very well. Andrade is the type of fighter that is extremely aggressive. I think they like to call her like Little Vonderlei, where she is just constantly pushing forward, throwing an extremely high amount of strikes per minute at a high pace. And while Calderwood can land at a high rate too, I think that Andrade can actually keep a pace so high that she might be able to overwhelm Calderwood, even though Calderwood is definitely the more technical striker and probably the more powerful in terms of pure one-punch power. Now, Andrade is pretty good on the ground as well, especially with the guillotine choke, so Calderwood has to be careful if she wants to mix in her wrestling here, because she will potentially leave her neck exposed on a takedown attempt. And I think, realistically, the best places for Calderwood to be are at the beginning of the rounds, if she can get her footwork going and try to keep this fight at range where she can get her kicks going and maybe the straight punches. And then, potentially, if she can get inside position in the clinch, I think she can do a lot of damage there. She has really devastating knees that can do some serious, serious punishment if they connect. So Andrade is going to have to be careful, but just with her style, I think it actually is a bit of a bad stylistic matchup for Calderwood. So the potential for the guillotine choke on a takedown attempt, and then, of course, the constant threat of just nonstop in-your-face punches that might be able to overwhelm Calderwood, I think, are very intriguing to me. And I think that Jessica Andrade can pull this off. I think as long as she keeps that pressure on Calderwood, then she might not give Calderwood a chance to just collect herself and settle into the fight. So I'm going to side with Jessica Andrade. Now, moving up to the bantamweight division, we have Uriah Faber, who is 33-9, taking on Jimmy Rivera, who is 19-1. Now, Nick, where did you open this fight, and how has the public shifted things so far?
I opened Faber -130, the comeback on Rivera at -110. And right now it's actually Rivera the favorite at -135. The comeback on Faber is +115. This was not an easy line to set. With all the respect that Faber gets, especially in non-title fights and what he's been able to accomplish throughout his career, I mean, he's become now a really tough gatekeeper. I mean, I hate to say that because Faber deserves better than that, but I'm saying, like, if you could beat Uriah Faber, obviously that you're the type of fighter that should be getting a title shot soon. And that's exactly what you're going to get with Faber. I mean, he's got that experience. He's got the ability to just his fight IQ in general to break down fighters and to get the fight to the ground when he has to. He's got the submission game that is just lethal at times. I mean, that guillotine choke is nasty. His rear naked choke is nasty as well. And his scrambling ability, his speed, he's got a little bit underrated power. Everything that you want to see with Faber is there. And that's why he's such a threat. Now, of course, when he stepped up again in those title fights, I mean, he's just, unfortunately for him, just not there. I mean, he's not up to par with some of these guys that are actually wearing the gold right now. And throughout his career, it's been that way. But outside of that, I mean, the guy's a very tough out. Rivera is one of these guys that's an up-and-coming fighter. He's looked phenomenal. I mean, the UFC has done him no favors thus far either throughout, I mean, the way they've matched him. But they've given Rivera all tough fights to start off his UFC career. And even before that, I mean, he was an Ultimate Fighter vet. And he actually, that was dating all the way back when Bermudez actually lost in the finals in that show. But when Bermudez was on the show, and he fought Bermudez and lost by second round TKO. But if you look back at that fight and look a little bit closer, he was actually, Rivera was winning that fight. He was out of his weight class. He was up a weight class, up a couple, because he's fighting He was up a weight class because he was fighting at 145 pounds on the show, and he's a bantamweight. So he was having his way with Bermudez, even in the wrestling aspect of that fight. So he won round one against Bermudez and then basically got caught, got rocked a little bit, and Bermudez took his back and then pounded him out on the ground. So that's how he lost that fight. But still, even that spot, I guess the one blemish that stands out, at least recently in people's minds, I mean, he wasn't even that bad there in that spot. And since that time, he's actually got his shot in the UFC, and they matched him up. I mean, Brimage, a tough out. To have your UFC debut against, especially at that time, against Marcus Brimage was not an easy fight. He looked good. He got the job done there and knocked him out. My most impressive fight for me with Rivera was the Munoz fight. Munoz is an extremely talented fighter, and that was just an outright war. I mean, Rivera showed a lot there. He showed a lot of heart. He faced adversity in that fight. He faced a very talented fighter that was capable of submitting him or knocking him out of the feet as well. And he came through that fight. I mean, it's hard to argue that he didn't deserve to get that nod. He looked really good. And then, of course, his win recently out over Alcantara. So the UFC has set this guy up with very difficult challengers, opponents, and he's been able to step through and just come away ahead. And he's looked great doing so. So I think this is another challenge. I mean, Faber coming off of a title loss, where does he go from here, really? I mean, there's not real upside. It's not like he's going to beat Rivera and then start beating these guys and get another title shot. I think Faber's title days are done. So they're basically using him as a gatekeeper right now, and they're bringing Rivera in because they know stylistically it's actually a pretty good matchup for Rivera in this spot. His wrestling should be good enough to be able to sprawl and brawl against Faber. And then on the feet right now, Rivera definitely has the edge. Both these guys are quick. They're going to be able to hit each other for sure with that speed, and they both have power. But I think Rivera is definitely the more devastating striker of the two. Rivera's chin overall is a little bit better than Faber's right now as well. And I think basically if he sprawls and brawls, he'll be able to outpoint Faber to hit the scorecards. Or if not, he can even possibly stop Faber on the feet as well. And again, I'm not the only one that's thinking this way. Obviously, the bettors out there are thinking this way as well. Everybody's kind of seems to be along the same line. That does worry me a little bit because as I mentioned in the fight before with Andrade and Calderwood, everybody coming in on Andrade kind of made me jump ship, but different scenario there, different spot. I think Calderwood legitimately has a shot to win that fight and everybody's counter out. And here, even though Faber always has a shot, especially with his submission game, I mean, you can never count the guy out. I still think that Rivera does get the job done. So I think we're all pretty much on the same page here. I think that Rivera, it's his time now. Again, another situation where the torch is kind of passed on. I mean, Faber was in the spotlight. This would be a great win for Rivera if he's able to get it done. And I think he can get it done the way these guys match up. So I think Rivera is going to come away with the biggest win of his career. And then he's going to be in the title mix. A lot of people are going to be impressed with what they see, and they're going to be talking about him. So his stock is going to go to a new level with the win over Faber. And I think he's probably going to get it.
The only thing that's even making me nervous about picking Jimmy Rivera here was the Michael McDonald versus Uriah Faber fight. Back then, we thought it was time that Faber was finally starting to slow down, that, you know, maybe that this was the perfect opportunity for a young up-and-comer to go in there and take out the savvy veteran. And then Faber just completely steamrolled him, dropped him on the feet, hurt him, and then submitted him quickly. So that's the concern. But that being said, that was a long time ago. I mean, honestly, Uriah Faber has fought so much more since then. He's fought for a title again since then. twice, actually, and lost both times. And so since that fight, he's gone 3-3. He's coming off of another loss in the title against Dominic Cruz. And that one kind of proved that I don't think he'll ever be able to be champ. And now Uriah Faber's 37 years old. So that was 3 years ago almost when he beat Michael McDonald. So he's got 3 more years of wear and tear in his body, 3 more years of tough, gritty fights against the top fighters in the division. And all that time, Jimmy Rivera has been going in there and just taking care of business. I mean, Jimmy Rivera is impressive. I mean, he got a great performance in his UFC debut with the knockout of Marcus Brimage. And then he takes on Pedro Munhoz, who, in my opinion, is an extremely underrated bantamweight on the roster, and takes him out in a very close, exciting fight of the year candidate type of fight, and then beats Yuri Alcantara. So he's looked great in his 3 UFC appearances, and he is a solid overall technical striker. I think his striking overall is better than Uriah Faber's, although maybe Faber packs a little bit more one-punch power. And his wrestling is spectacular. He doesn't use it a lot, but I think he can definitely use it defensively if Faber is kind of looking to use his ground game, use his takedowns, and then maybe try to get a submission at some point to win this fight. I think Rivera can use that wrestling in reverse, keep the fight standing, and then just go to work. Rivera has a very slight reach advantage, although Faber actually is a little bit taller. And I just think overall, Rivera should be able to control this fight. Faber has looked like he's slowed down a little bit, especially as fights go on. I don't think his conditioning is as good as it used to be, although part of that was, the Frankie Saints fight where he just emptied the gas tank trying to finish Saints and then couldn't do it. And then that really hurt him as the fight wore on. But for the most part, I think if Rivera just keeps this fight standing, keeps a jab in Faber's face, then he's going to be able to either win a decision or maybe even knock Faber out. I mean, you saw Faber get dropped at least twice by Dominic Cruz, who is not exactly known as a real heavy hitter. And I think Rivera does have the ability here to potentially knock Faber out as well. So I'm siding with Jimmy Rivera. I think he can win this fight. I think that he can either pick up a finish or, if he plays it safe, win a competitive decision, because, you can never completely count out Faber. And I know I'm kind of making it sound like this is going to be a one-sided fight, but you just never know with Faber. He has always usually performed very well in non-title fights, but I think that Jimmy Rivera has the ability, and he is on the rise as a top guy in the division, that this might finally be the opportunity for a non-title fight guy to pick up an impressive performance. So I'm siding with Jimmy Rivera. Now moving on to perhaps the most intriguing fight of the card, we have former WWE champion CM Punk making his professional mixed martial arts debut with a 0-0 record, taking on Mickey Gall, who is 2-0. Now, Nick, what's the MMA odds maker's perspective on this one?
Up in Gall -380, the comeback on Punk +260. Right now, it's currently Gall -470. The comeback on Punk is +375. So line has increased. There has been some action coming in Gall's way as of late. But make no mistake, early action was all on Punk, and the sportsbooks are probably going to be pretty even on this fight despite the line move. Because, and at the same time, you guys got to understand something. Once lines go live and they do the craziness, especially early on, if you know, I mean, early movement gets ridiculous at times. But by the time stuff settles in at times, they try to opinionate things, or they try to stick to what makes the most sense. So they're going to gradually increase. If I say, look, Gall's going to beat Punk, I'm pretty confident in this or whatever, they're going to probably increase the line as it goes a little bit more to keep people betting Punk in a situation like this than it will to get buried by Gall action. So even though there's not a ton of action coming in possibly on Gall at the moment, the line could still climb a little bit, if that makes sense, to try to feed in some bets on CM Punk. Now, again, it all depends on how well the sportsbooks listen and the employees and all that stuff too. So it is a circus at times, but at the same time, in a case like this, hopefully they do things right. And that is a situation, and they might even need Gall to get out with a win here, which is probably the way to go. I mean, none of us really know how CM Punk's going to perform or do. We all just really speculate. I mean, he's at a good camp with Duke Rufus. We see the training footage out there. You know, you could hear some rumors about how he's doing as well. You got to respect the guy. The guy's working hard. He's taking this serious. He's got a good camp and crew behind him. There's a lot of good things being said, but on film, obviously he's not very impressive to any of us out there. I've heard the comments. I've seen the comments as well along the way. And unfortunately for Punk, I do believe that he's just going to be too raw. He's not going to be ready for a guy like Gall. Gall's still relatively young. I mean, he's only 24 years old. He is definitely the more complete fighter of the two. And the sad thing is, I mean, he's still raw. He's still going to develop his game overall. So from what we do know, I mean, it just the time that Gall has put into the sport compared to the time that Punk has is just unfair almost at the moment. And not just that, but the real time experience with amateur fights, with getting a couple fights in the cage. I mean, that experience alone for a debuting fighter is going to be tough to beat as well. So there, all signs are indicating towards Gall here. I think Gall can beat him on the feet. I think Gall probably gets him down and subs. Even if he's on the bottom, I think he scrambles out of a bad spot and probably finishes Punk by submission anyway. So, I mean, again, we're all kind of blindly going into this fight a little bit. So that's not any time a scenario that you'd want to see. But in my opinion, other than maybe Punk getting lucky, landing a haymaker on the feet or something crazy like that happening, he's not going to beat Gall in this spot. So I'm fairly confident that Gall should get the W here. Gall's actually pretty impressive if you look at him. I mean, he's got a pretty complete game overall. And again, he's going to continue to get better. So I just think that the UFC debut for Punk, unfortunately for him, is just not going to be a great one. So there's going to be a lot of disappointed WWE fans tuning in to watch this fight, because I think Gall finishes him off. So we'll see. I won't spend much more time on this fight. It is what it is, but I do think Mickey Gall defeats CM Punk.
I think this fight's pretty straightforward. They brought in a guy to make his UFC debut for the opportunity to fight CM Punk and Mickey Gall, and he looked great. And the problem is, I think he's just way too good for CM Punk. I mean, CM Punk is a guy that had never really thrown a real strike in his life. Everything, you know, you have to pull all your punches in the WWE. You have to make it look good, and it wasn't about actually landing good shots. Same thing with this, you know, submissions and all that other stuff. I mean, he did a little bit of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu training before switching to mixed martial arts. And it's been about 2 years now since the UFC made the announcement that they had signed CM Punk and he was going to fight. So I'm glad that this is finally happening. My problem is they picked an opponent that's too good. Mickey Gall is a really talented young fighter. I mean, he trains with the Miller brothers. He is a very, very solid grappler. And even though CM Punk has done some training with some of the Gracies in California, and he's been working with the Duke Rufus over the past 2 years, a lot of that time he's also spent injured. I mean, he's had his debut delayed repeatedly with injuries. He's up there in age. That's the big concern is, you know, even if he had 2 full years with no injuries or whatsoever, he'd still be way behind Mickey Gall. And Mickey Gall's a guy that's been competing in grappling tournaments. He's experienced. He dominates his two opponents so far in his mixed martial arts career. Granted, they were complete cans, but he still is just light years ahead of CM Punk at this point. And he also showcased some heavy hands in his UFC debut with that win over Mike Jackson. So I think this is going to be a really bad fight for CM Punk. I don't expect him to really be that competitive. And I think once it goes to the floor, it's going to be real bad for Punk because of Gall's submission ability and overall grappling skills. And I think on the feet, it's going to be bad for CM Punk. I mean, I'm very curious about the fight just to see how he looks, to see what skills he's really developed and what he's able to showcase. But I just don't think he's going to be very competitive here. So I have to side with Mickey Gall. Now moving on to the co-main event of the evening in the heavyweight division, we have the former champion Fabricio Werdum, who is 26-1, taking on Travis Brown, who is 18-4-1. Now, Nick, where did you open this fight, and how has the public shifted things so far?
I put Verdun minus 270, the comeback on Brown at plus 190. Right now, looking over five dimes, it is Verdun minus 210, the comeback on Brown is plus 175. So 15-cent drop on the dog overall. Line margins have tightened up a little bit. And there is, again, two-way action coming out of this fight. It's been out a while. I mean, we've seen the first fight, and surprising us all, really. I mean, Brown was a favorite going into the first fight. We thought he'd be able to sprawl brawl and just kind of dismantle Verdun. That's what the thinking at that time was, at least. It didn't happen. Verdun showed up. His striking was a lot better than we all expected. Brown was a lot worse than we all expected at that moment in that fight, at least. And that was kind of the signs of the stock levels dropping on Brown, even though he's facing a world-class fighter and one of the best heavyweights of all time in MMA. I mean, you got to consider Verdun in that slot, considering his pride days, everything that he's accomplished throughout his career, winning that UFC strap as well. I mean, Verdun is definitely up there as one of the best heavyweight fighters, I think, in my opinion, at least of all time. Now, I'm not saying the best, but one of them you got to consider. You got to respect the guy. So with all that being said, I mean, Brown is in for an uphill battle again. I mean, Verdum's striking has improved to the point where it's serviceable. He doesn't need to beat you on the ground like he used to back in the day. I mean, he's been putting in the work. He's been nothing but impressive. He's been getting more confidence. He's been getting better. Now, of course, he just recently had a setback in his last fight where he lost his title to Stipe, which we'll get into in the next fight. He was just, I think, a little bit overconfident, going in a little bit too aggressive, got caught. And it happens. I mean, especially a heavyweight. These guys can definitely knock each other out, obviously, as well. So one solid punch to the chin, bam, the night's over. But outside of that, Verdum is definitely the better fighter here, even though it's going to be a challenge. I mean, Brown just got dismantled by Cain Velasquez. He wanted to get back in there. He asked for this fight. He wanted to you know, come in on short notice as a replacement here in this spot and kind of redeem himself. And I can understand it. You got to respect Brown for even wanting it. I mean, if you have a performance like you did against Cain Velasquez and you can redeem one of your losses coming in, I mean, you got to respect the warrior part of him that wants to kind of make things right again and wants to get back on track. And if Brown is able to get the W against Verdun, he is going to get some of that respect back and he'll be right back in the mix. So this is a very important fight for both guys. Verdun wins it, he'll be back in line for a possible title shot. I think regardless of who wins the Stipe and Overeem fight, I don't think Verdum's going to get the next shot. I think it is going to be Cain Velasquez that probably gets that shot. But after that, Verdum's going to be right there in the mix. So he could possibly have the shot after that as well if he does get the job done here as well. So with all that being said, it's hard to pick against Verdun here. I mean, Brown could possibly knock him out. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Verdun is 39 years old. So he definitely has had a solid chin throughout his career. But Stipe knockout, of course. And the only other time before that, we need to say that he's been knocked out was against JDS. In that fight, it wasn't the Verdun we're all used to seeing. It wasn't because of declining skills or anything like that. He was just, honestly, he was out of shape in that fight. He didn't take the fight serious. I think he underestimated JDS back then, got clipped early, got put out, and that was that. So really, he's only been knocked out twice in his whole career, and he's been in a tremendous amount of wars against very good competition. So for the most part, his chin is actually pretty solid, and he's a tough guy to get rid of. So Brown is going to have his hands full here because he can't beat Verdun on the ground, and the striking aspect, at least in the first fight, went over towards Verdun as well. It's only a three-round fight. I don't think Verdun's going to gas and kind of slow down as much. So hard fight for Brown. He's got a puncher's chance, though. It's a tough spot to bet in a heavyweight division, laying over 2-1 against two guys that could land and knock each other out. I'm going to lean a little bit more towards Verdun, though. I think he is the better fighter, and I think he does get back on track here.
I mean, just going by their last fight, it was a 5-round thrashing of Travis Brown. And this time, Travis Brown's taken the fight on short notice. The only difference now is, you know, Verdun kind of tasted the top of the sport. He was the champ. He's coming in off of a devastating knockout loss to Stipe Miocic where he lost his title. So how he reacts to that is going to be really important because we haven't seen Verdun hurt like that. We haven't seen Verdun in a bad position like that since Junior Dos Santos knocked him out of the UFC the first time around. So the last time that happened, Verdun really applied himself and became one of the best heavyweights in the world. Perhaps the best heavyweight in the world. So if he responds like that, then Travis Brown's in a huge world of trouble because Brown has not looked great ever since he started teaming up with Edmund and those guys. His striking has started to look worse. And I just think if Verdun just keeps the same game plan as last time of just staying in Brown's face, flustering him, using a lot of misdirection, and just attacking constantly while avoiding the big shot, then I think Verdum should win easily. He also has a huge advantage on the ground if the fight goes there. So the main thing here is he has to watch out for Travis Brown's kicks. Brown is athletic, so maybe, you know, something like a Superman punch or something could connect with Verdum. And Brown is big and long, so that also could factor in. It's just all about Verdum protecting his chin, and if he does that, then he should win. If he doesn't, if he gets clipped, then Brown has a chance to win. But for the most part, I have to side with Verdum. He's just completely steamrolled Brown the last time, and I don't see anywhere that Brown has improved since that fight. So I got to side with Fabricio Verdum. Now moving on to the main event of the evening, we have the UFC heavyweight title on the line as champion Stipe Miocic, who is 15-2, defends against Alistair Overeem, who is 41-14 with one no contest. Now, Nick, what's the MMA oddsmaker's perspective on this one?
I opened Stipe -170, the comeback on Overeem at +140, and the action has been coming in steady. It's been out for a while now, but the action has been coming in on Overeem. And right now it's down to Stipe -135. The comeback on Overeem is at +115. Now, of course, there is some action coming back in on Stipe. And, you know, this fight will probably be fairly even as far as the sports books are concerned with two-way action, because both these guys are going to get a tremendous amount of respect. They're both two of the best heavyweights in the UFC. Overeem has been around for so long, former K-1 champion, former Strikeforce champion. I mean, his resume speaks for itself. He is definitely a talented fighter, and he's always been, really. And now he seems to really been finding his groove. I mean, you can't argue him getting this title shot, honestly. I mean, for a while, there was that concern with Overeem's conditioning and his chin. I mean, those are the big two factors that you always have to consider when betting or picking Overeem. Is his cardio going to hold up? Is his chin going to hold up against, you know, decent, solid competition? And a lot of times, I mean, you want to stay away or bet the other side because of those reasons alone. But it seems like he has definitely got himself in a good position, got his mindset right. Strategy-wise, he's coming up with a good game plan. He respects Greg Jackson and crew, the people that he's training with. So there are a lot of good things from Overeem. I mean, he's put together a nice little win streak here as well. So I think, again, he is deserving of the shot, and it's going to be a tough fight for Stipe because Overeem is not the type of fighter that you could get down to the ground easily and control him on the ground. I mean, he has good wrestling in his own right, good takedown defense, and then he is one of the best strikers in the heavyweight division. So how does Stipe beat this guy? I mean, a lot of people, that's why they're coming in on Overeem. He has that crazy knockout power, and I mean, it doesn't take much for him to get people out of there. But I do think Stipe is the better fighter at this stage of their careers. I mean, he's younger, even in fight years. Even though Stipe has been in some wars now in the UFC, I think he still hasn't had or absorbed the punishment throughout his career that a guy like Overeem has. So at some point, it does kind of sneak up on you, and it sneaks up on you kind of fast. I still think the conditioning of Stipe is better as well. I think he's going to be a little bit faster. I think he's going to have a little bit better footwork, obviously, than Overeem as well. So I think it's going to be a challenge for both of these guys, but I think that Stipe is going to be landing a little bit more frequently. He's going to be the busier fighter along the way, and I think if he game plans this properly and he's able to wear Overeem out as a fight progresses a little bit as well, he is going to have success, especially as the fight goes on a little bit more. I do trust him more. I mean, Stipe, a lot of people can point to that Struve loss. That was, I mean, dating back a few years now, obviously, in that spot. That was, I think, the worst spot of Stipe's career, the worst moment there. He won round one easily, and then round two ended up getting caught and knocked out. It was just, I don't know, it was an ugly fight for him there. But since that time, I mean, Stipe's chin has been very solid. He's been clipped by heavy hitters, and he's absorbed that punishment, and it doesn't seem to be an issue at all. And for me, a while back as well, I was a little bit worried and concerned about Stipe's cardio. But again, since that time, he showed us that he can go five rounds, and he could go at a high pace. I mean, look what he did to Mark Hunt, for example. So Stipe's legit, and in my opinion, he is definitely one of the best heavyweight fighters in the UFC right now. That's why he's wearing that strap, and he's going to be a tough guy to beat. I mean, a lot of people will say, you know, the UFC heavyweight division, that two fight situation where the title holder is not able to defend his belt more than two fights or whatnot. Stipe is the type of fighter that can break that mold and can hold on to this belt for a long time, regardless of the competition he's going to face. Obviously, the next fight, like I mentioned earlier, could be Cain Velasquez if Stipe does win this fight. So that's going to be a heck of a challenge, and a challenge that is definitely going to be the most like difficult fight of his career if he gets passed Overeem, but that's a big if because Overeem is definitely a challenge here as well. So with that being said, I still think that Stipe right now is coming into his groove. He's coming into his own as a fighter, mentally, physically, everything. He knows what he can do. He's even developing more confidence in his knockout power in at the highest level as well. He's finishing fights now. So I like what I see in Stipe. I think he's legitimately one of the best fighters in the world. And I think Overeem, that chin is going to get checked. It's going to not pass the test as the fight progresses here a little bit. I think if he does go into deep waters against Stipe, he's going to lose that fight as well. So I just think that Stipe is the better fighter in this spot right now. And I think that Overeem is not going to be able to get rid of him. And that's going to be bad for Overeem because he's in turn going to probably get finished as well. So I think Stipe is the better fighter and he's probably going to knock Overeem out.
If you've watched Alistair Overeem over his last few fights, he's definitely made some really smart adjustments to his style. Earlier in his UFC career, he was just kind of balls out, get in your face, try to take your opponent out quickly. And if that didn't work, he would run out of steam and get knocked out. It happened against Travis Brown. It happened against Antonio Silva, where he wasn't able to get the finish, and then he got clipped and put away. And it was extremely frustrating because you knew how talented he was, but then he switched over to Jackson Winklejohn and everything changed. He started fighting a lot smarter, utilizing his great reach. He has an 80-inch reach. He has very long legs, extremely powerful kicks, started fighting at distance, being more patient. And then the knockouts just started happening anyway, where he is probably the most accurate striker in the entire division. I mean, he lands like 60% of his punches and kicks. That is insane. And he has relatively good defense. It's just about chin strength, and he definitely is lacking in that department. And the thing that Overeem has been doing is he's been working it from distance. He kind of lulls his opponent to sleep a little bit and then pounces, whether it's that kick up the middle against Arlovsky that rocked him and set up the finish, or the big punch on Junior Dos Santos that took him out after basically a round of a snooze fest where he barely threw a strike. So what Stipe needs to do is not let Overeem stall this fight out. Overeem is at his best at distance and being patient, and what he's been using lately is just kind of sitting back and waiting to react to what his opponent does. And if Stipe wants to really force the pressure, I think that he can do a great job here. The main thing is he has to force Overeem to work, because if Overeem has to work, that's where he starts to get tired. And if Stipe can kind of force this into more of a phone booth fight, I think his boxing is just as good as Overeem's. He just needs to make Overeem work, make him defend, make him feel the pressure. Don't let those kicks become a factor. If you get on the inside, it's a lot tougher for Overeem to land those devastating body kicks like the one that took out Brock Lesnar, or the one that folded Travis Brown in half and almost finished that fight, or the one that he landed right up the middle on Arlovsky to set up that finish. So Stipe has to fight smart, because you can't just trade kickboxing with Alistair Overeem from distance. You have to pressure him, get in his face, kind of like what I am hoping Andrade does against Calderwood. Now, obviously you can't force it too much like Werdum was doing against Stipe, where he was just charging forward, trying to land punches, and then he got clipped coming in and put out. But if Miocic is able to kind of force this into a phone booth fight and make Overeem work harder than he was expecting, I think he can wear him out. Miocic has better conditioning than Overeem. I think Miocic has the better chin. So if they're trading evenly, then, you know, he can definitely hurt Overeem and without getting as hurt in even exchanges. It's just all about not letting those kicks become a factor and not letting this fight slow down. And if he can do that, then I think he can win. On the ground, Miocic is a pretty solid wrestler, although he doesn't really threaten with submissions. Although if he gets top position, he can definitely land some punches, as you saw in the Hunt fight. And Overeem is a pretty solid wrestler as well, and he has a very underrated ground game. He has some finishes by TKO on top position, and of course he also has several submissions from his pre-UFC career. So Miocic, I doubt that this fight really has a lot going on the canvas. I think it's going to primarily take place on the feet, and I think Stipe Miocic can defend the title as well. He just cannot have a slow-paced kickboxing fight if he wants to win. So I'm going to side with Stipe Miocic as well. So that'll do it for our full event breakdown for UFC 203. Now, our premium bets will be released this Friday following the weigh-in, so stay tuned for that if you're an MMA Odds Breaker premium member. If we have a free play to give out, make sure to follow at MMAOBPremium on Twitter, because that's where we'll post them first. We can also notify you of our free bets via email alert if you prefer that method. Just send an email to picks@MMAOddsbreaker.com and we'll add you to our free bet mailing list. Special thanks to our sponsor, Five Dime Sportsbook. Good luck, everyone, and hopefully the betting gods are on your side this weekend.